Three, two, one. Welcome back to The New Talk, the Bob Davis Podcasts, podcast 421. So the time has come for us to talk again about political polls. Had a lot of fun this weekend and some conversations with friends, and I've come to the conclusion that people are deeply confused about what the results of modern political polling actually mean. And it's beginning to affect political conversations. So in podcast 421, I'm going to draw on some of my experience polling and talk a little bit about polls, polling, and results. And just as one added aside, I don't have enough time to talk about what the political scientists do with this data and how they work. And I think that's really something I want to do another podcast on, because I think people need to know how people manage campaigns and how they figure out what to talk about and how they examine political history. I think that's a really important point, and we just won't have time in this podcast to do that. Now, history demonstrates that one of the paths to personal wealth is through property ownership. A lot of people are renting while they wait to purchase their first home or move up to their next home. And it's also true that in the last 5 years or so, there have been many foreclosures and houses sitting empty for extended periods of time. And then you have house flippers who renovate using cheap materials and so forth. So there is a fair amount of risk out there when it comes to buying a house, especially if it's your first house. To negotiate that risk, you need real estate professionals that understand the market. They know, they understand the individual properties. Interest rates have been near historically low levels for many years. They are still essentially zero, 1 or 2 or 3% in terms of 4% in terms of borrowing. But there is pressure to increase rates, and yet the Fed may increase rates in December. So this is the time to take advantage of historically low interest rates if you're in the market for real estate or someone close to you is considering buying their first home. I want to introduce prideofhomes.com to listeners and subscribers to the Bob Davis Podcast for this reason. Prideofhomes.com is a husband, wife, licensed real estate agent team, and real estate investors with expertise to share with you. So take a moment and talk with Eric and Aram Lucero with Luke Team Real Estate and Pride of Homes.com. You can call them at 763-433-9100, 763-433-9100, or visit their website at prideofhomes.com. They're in the North and Northwest Metro, so Plymouth, Rogers, Dayton, Champlin, Elk River, and so forth. For real estate experience and expertise, Eric and Aram Lucero with Luke Team Real Estate. Visit their website again today at prideofhomes.com. And thanks to the digital sponsors of the BobDavisPodcast.com, Buzzlets, I'll tell you about that later in the podcast, and Alpha Systems. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, we have pilots listening to the Bob Davis Podcast, and we want to keep you safe. Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Get it installed in your avionics package. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's FAA-approved revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. If you get most of your information from cable television, you're going to see a lot of polls. TV loves polls almost as much as a fire, right? TV is low information and high emotion, and poll results can be presented graphically, which makes a TV channel look smart. It creates the impression of depth when there isn't any. It can be discussed by individuals or panels. It provides a lot of fodder for talk show hosts, and it has high impact. A good poll result can be a goldmine for a candidate or an issue, because first you have the candidate or the issue, and if it polls well, in the parlance, then you can talk about how it polls well, which makes it poll well. They also then create an instant storyline. And if you have a lot of people involved in an election or a multifaceted issue, you've got all kinds of storylines which you can play out day after day after day, hour after hour after hour. And when you're filling 24 hours of programming with vacuous content, this is something that's very handy, because you can actually strip it out day to day and do pieces after pieces after pieces on it. This person is on top. This this week, but look, here's this other guy coming up close behind. Or what happened to this guy? He was the front runner 6 months ago, and now look at his polls. And of course, the experts and the pundits will go say, well, you know, that part where he wore the tennis shoes in Iowa at that thing was probably the when it started. And it may have had nothing to do with what was going on with this particular candidate or this guy or this issue. It also provides an opportunity for polling companies to show off their stuff to potential customers, political and otherwise. They provide polling data to the networks and they get free advertising, or the newspapers and the networks actually pay pollsters to provide polling data for their use. And then some news organizations actually conduct their own polls through a provider. The overall effect of this polling essentially is to provide data points to the networks, as I explained, so they can turn actual news coverage, the coverage of politics, into sports. Now, here's the thing that's interesting, because in sports, of course, there is something tangible to measure because the teams actually play the games. So you have actual storylines because they actually play the games and they win or lose. This team got this many hits, runs, and errors and has won this many contests. This player has this batting average and so on. That data can then be compared to actual historic data on hits, runs, errors, things like that. And at the end of the playing season, champions actually emerge. This is not so with the political season so far. No game has been played. Not a single vote has been cast in any kind of forum, whether it is a caucus, whether it is some group of people at an event. I mean, there are straw polls and things like that, but there's been no actual voting by the population on any of these candidates. But national debates, the forum in which candidates to be put in charge of the most expensive and the most dangerous government in the world, a government with the power to bomb hospitals or to monitor your online and smartphone activity, to drag you out of your house in the middle of the night because you're a terrorist, to demand certain behaviors from you at the point of a gun, literally, those people are judged on one thing and one thing only, and that's poll results. And then people like us make wild assertions about polls, which is the reason for this podcast. Here's some quotes. Trump is on top, but that doesn't mean he will win a general election. Hillary Clinton doesn't stand a chance because 20,000 people showed up for a Bernie Sanders rally in Massachusetts. Ben Carson is going to be the nominee. Donald Trump is not or is going to be the nominee, and so on. Provoking Dana Milbank to write this weekend, Trump will fade and he won't be the nominee. Well, so what? Anybody can say that. We don't know who the nominee is going to be at this point, as I'll explain later. So to review, late this winter and throughout the spring and early summer in 2016, a series of state elections and caucuses will be held. As far as I can tell, 50 states hold presidential primaries or caucuses or mixes thereof. Some are actual local elections where people are voting on referenda or local or state offices, and so they might have little higher levels of turnout while they're also voting in the primary. Some are simply elections where people vote by party for the candidates they like, and the winner takes some or all of the delegates to the National Party Convention, which then nominates the candidates for the President of the United States. Some of these are caucuses, which are not straight-up elections with ballots, but gatherings where other business is done, including usually some kind of straw poll, which is a loose type of voting for the preferred presidential candidate. I remember people tearing up paper and writing names of candidates on scraps of paper and putting them in plastic bags, which then went to the back of the room where someone counted them. That's how caucuses are done. That's how straw polls are done. Is that scientific? Does that determine the winner of the national election? A caucus is defined as a meeting of a group of people with shared concerns within a political party or larger group. Usually you caucus with your brethren in the political party of your choice, but some states have something called an open primary where Democrats can cross over and vote on the Republican ballot and vice versa, and that affects the results. As far as I know, there's no set rule in Minnesota where we have caucuses that says you have to be a registered Democrat to caucus with the Democrats. Maybe there is. I've never tried to caucus with the Democrats. I wouldn't know. Or a registered Republican to caucus with the Republicans, but there are so few people in a Republican caucus, they would probably welcome a Democrat. And if there's any overflow, they would probably welcome the Democrats, because usually you'll go to a local school and there'll be 100 people caucusing with the Democrats and a room of three or four people by precinct in the Republican caucus. I think it's important to point out that U.S. elections, especially national elections, are actually 50 local elections and more than 50 if you include territories. Primaries and caucuses are governed by the specific laws of individual states, even on election day, the election day, where people are choosing between respective party nominees. These are state elections, and they're governed by state election law. We elect senators, representatives, state offices, and local offices, but the Electoral College actually elects presidents, not the general population. Moreover, each party sets the rules for primaries and caucuses and their conventions. So just because somebody wins the majority of delegates for a particular party convention doesn't automatically mean they will be the nominee. Don't ask me to give you examples, but I'm sure there are some. Why is this important about a podcast that involves polling? Because you can see from the preceding comments that I've made about state primaries and conventions that the end result is separated from polling results to a very high degree. Some of those rules are very complex in each state election law, and each party's rules are different when you get into conventions and the law and the rule at conventions. So then we get to the polls. Most of the time, polls suck. And to prove it, here are a series of questions you should try to answer before you go around touting a poll result to friends and family at Thanksgiving. How many people were in the sample? Because if it's 750 in Iowa, that means you can't say anything about demographics supporting a particular candidate like Donald Trump is popular with women, for example. And if it's 1,000 people nationwide, throw it in the trash. It's not a big enough sample. How was the poll conducted? Was it done by an actual person? In other words, a person versus an autonomous machine. Who did it? Who were the polling people? Who were the interviewers? How did they do it? Was it done by a machine or, you know, an autonomous speaking software? What machine? What does it sound like when it calls you? How many people with cell phones were included in the sample? How were individuals that were included in the survey selected? Was it conducted online? Who responded and where were they from and how do you know it was them, right? Was there any attempt to verify the results by the polling firm, as in calling back some of the respondents to make sure they were contacted and actually took the survey, especially if the poll was done by human beings? I'll give you an example. We used to call thousands of people a week in New York and play 30 songs for them, and they would listen to little song hooks, and they would say whether they liked the song a lot or not a lot. And at one point, we got some bizarre results because the people that listened to an RB station turned out to really like Bon Jovi. And I remember having a big argument with my boss about why couldn't people who listened to a disco station like Bon Jovi, okay? And he said, because he was experienced and knew the stations and knew the market, he said, that's ridiculous. You need to go back there and call these people back and find out if they were actually surveyed. Well, I refuse to do it. You know, you're maligning the honesty of these people that are doing the polling, and this is wrong. And he said, you go back there. And you take those interviews and you take the phone and you call those respondents back and you find out if they were being contacted. Well, it didn't take long to find out that somebody was making up poll results. They were filling out the surveys because there was an incentive for people to turn in a lot of interviews, and one of the women was making them up, and she liked Bon Jovi, and that was the end of that. So she got fired, and I learned a very, very painful lesson about polling. It's very dependent on the people who actually do the poll. In all fairness, most professional polling firms audit their interviewers and the interviews and poll results, but sometimes if they're rushing to get it out, even the best firms may let that go at the last second to get the poll out. The other thing is, how were the questions asked? What questions were asked? How many times was the sample used? If the poll is a trend, so if that it includes a number of polls as a trend, how big is the sample for each trend? Because if it's a small sample size for each trend, you can trend it if the questions are the same, but you can't take an individual trend and look at that as anything of any value. Who did the analysis? How do they know what the poll numbers mean? Are they political scientists that just graduated from college, or are they experienced polls, meaning political people, who understand Iowa, who understand Arkansas, who understand the political vagaries in Minnesota or Wisconsin? Are the pollsters working for any of the major candidates or parties or news agencies? And the people doing the poll, are they mixing and matching on those different clients? So if they're doing a poll for Fox, are they also working for a Democrat or a Republican candidate? That's an important question to ask. And it includes everything all the way back to, hey, it's Charlie. Let's do a poll this week for the evening news, when Charlie calls from CBS or NBC or Fox or whatever and calls the polling company and says, let's do a poll. How did they, who made that decision? Now, most of the times, these questions are easily answered, but I'm going to go through each of these areas with a fine-tooth comb, or as fine-tooth a comb as possible, in a half-hour podcast, so you're not going to sound like an idiot the next time you start talking about polls at your friend's party. Well, as the political season kind of progresses, we are going to start to see cooler and cooler weather. We've certainly seen all the summer celebrations that signal the end of summer coming fast. The weather's already changed up in Minnesota, and Greg Ryan of Ryan Plumbing and Heating wants you to know that with winter coming, like they say on the show Game of Thrones, it is time to have Ryan check your heating systems, and here's why. Today, it's all about integrating smart tech with your heating systems to make them more efficient. And if you haven't had your heating system upgraded in the last 5 years, Ryan can upgrade you and save you a lot of money during the mini ice age we call winter in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And the thing is, first of all, you should have your heating checked to make sure everything's working right, because if it fails in the middle of winter, it's a disaster. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you get it upgraded, you can save an awful lot of money over a long period of time. So you want to call Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul and ask about smart tech. You also want to ask them about in-floor heating, especially with low interest rates. People are redoing their basements, they're redoing bathrooms, and in-floor heating is an awesome thing. We had that in one of the houses that I grew up in, and I just loved being able to stand on the tile and feel that warmth. So if you're redoing a bathroom, just think about being able to get out of the shower on a cold winter morning and stand on a nice, toasty, warm floor. It's pretty great. In Minneapolis, call Ryan at 612-927-6488. In St. Paul, you can call 651-224-4771. Metro-wide from St. Paul, that means the suburbs of Minneapolis and St. Paul, 2-for-4 generation, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. Ryan Plumbing and Heating on University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol. Once again, in St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, metro-wide from St. Paul for over 60 years, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. And thanks to the digital sponsors of the Bob Davis Podcasts, of course, Alpha Systems and Buzzlets. If you take a look at the banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast, you're going to see a Buzzlets banner. Click on it and learn about a new long-range device that enables you to get your kids' attention without screaming and yelling and waving your arms, whether they're at the water park or on the soccer field or down the street. The kid wears a watch-like device, and then you have this controller that contacts them if you need them to come in or whatever. Buzzlets is starting their Indiegogo campaign. It's like Kickstarter, so click on the ad. It'll take you to their Indiegogo page, and you can find out about this amazing device. They could use your support, so check it out, Buzzlets, and thanks you guys for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. So let's talk about polls, and we'll start with sample. The law of random sampling only says that everyone has an equal chance to participate in the survey, and there are exceptions, but I'll get into that later. If I'm doing a poll, that means brand new, pristine people who have not been part of any of the polls I've done before, right? And that becomes very difficult, especially when you get into demographics that are difficult to get into the survey. But it also means that you can't only talk to people in the bus station or people with landlines. And that presents a lot of difficulty because people's cell numbers aren't readily available these days. So my question is, how do firms get cell numbers and how many? Have you ever been contacted by a pollster on your cell phone? And if you did, I'd love to know the process. Did you agree to have them call? It's not meant to say, they aren't making the calls because they've never called me, which is, I hear that all the time. Well, I've never been in a survey. Well, that doesn't mean anything. You may have had an equal chance to participate in the survey, and that's the main thing. So when it gets to when it comes to cell numbers and online, you start wondering, well, how do people find respondents? And the only exception to this in terms of sample is there is an unwritten law, and it may be a law, but I experienced it myself, and it's fascinating. If you get there's a point at which if you get thousands and thousands and thousands of response, then it kind of obviates standard deviation. So if you have 37,000 people in a poll, that tends to you tend to not have to worry about all of these sampling issues, but you still have to worry whether the results, the people that are involved in the survey are stratified by things like geography. So if you're surveying a state with half the population on the east side of the state and half the population on the other, your sample should be at least 50% from the east and 50% from the west. But it ends up being a lot more complicated than that because you have to stratify the sample by county and within districts by population and demographics. One of the most difficult things in Minnesota to poll is northern Minnesota because it's so dispersed and you have Indian reservations. So you have all kinds of problems associated with polling the northern part of the state of Minnesota and probably some of the states out west because of things like that. And when you get into demographics, in other words, 18 to 24-year-old males, 18 to 24-year-old females, 25 to 44s, whatever the demographics you want to look at, if you're doing an 18-plus voter poll, you have to have the right percentages of different subgroups of demographics represented as a sample that reflects the population in tabulation for the final poll results. Why? Because of a terrible monster in polling known as standard deviation. And here's the definition of it. In statistics, the standard deviation, also represented by the Greek letter sigma for the population standard deviation, or S for the sample standard deviation, is a measure that is used to quantify the amount of variation or dispersion of a set of data values. In practice, that means you, if you have too small of a sample and it has to be dispersed geographically and demographically, then really the only data that has any value is the number based on the total. So if you call 500 people and you try to make predictions or valuations or analysis about individual demographics, you really can't because the sample sizes are too small. And so we never get a chance to check that. When you hear about a poll taken in Iowa, you don't know what the geographic sample is. You don't know how many people have been in that survey before. You don't know who did the poll. You don't know how it was done. So who gets to be in the survey is a very, very, very important question. In radio, we used to ask people whether they had listened to a radio station for at least 5 minutes in a given week or day during the period of the survey. If they didn't, then they didn't get in the survey, because why go to St. Paul if you want to find out if it's raining in Minneapolis, right? In politics, you have to ask a series of questions to determine how likely the person is to vote in a primary election, which have very low voter turnout to begin with. Here again, when you're dealing with smaller sample sizes that have to be controlled geographically and demographically, if the voter screen is too tight, it will affect overall sample. And if it doesn't effectively predict likelihood to vote, the data is going to be affected on both counts. And where do we get the numbers? Do we get the numbers from voter registration rolls? Right? So you're not generally, if you do that, you're not actually surveying the whole population. You're just surveying people who registered to vote, for example. Then we get to the questions. Who are you going to vote for in a primary election is a different question from who are you going to caucus for obvious reasons, because caucuses are different from primary elections. Which candidate, and you can fill in the blank, is a different question from who your favorite guy to be president of the United States is. When there are 17 potential Republican candidates and 5 or 6 potential Democrat candidates, the poll gets pretty long and most people have other things to do. And if you don't ask Republicans about the Democrats, then you're really not getting an idea of what the potential is for a particular candidate. Now, you say, well, what about an online poll? Why not do it online? And I don't know about you, but for me to spend 20 minutes online clicking options in a poll is a considerable investment of my time. So I'm going to be a pretty politically involved person. And how do they know that I actually read the questions and didn't just respond to the names, especially when you get toward the end of the survey? So we go through all of that. The poll gets done, and the answer is Trump has a plurality of votes to become the candidate for the Republicans, or Ben Carson has this many votes, this percentage of the voting public, or Carly Farina, or Jeb Bush, or whatever. Is that what the poll says? Or are they measuring name recognition and awareness of a particular candidate? And as an example, remember when Bill Clinton got impeached? He was on TV every day for weeks. And when it came around to them actually removing him from office, the cowardly senators realized Clinton had the support of most Americans on, in the country and according to the polls, because he was on TV for 6 weeks before this. So who's on TV? Actually, he was on TV for a year before this all the time. So who's on TV lately? Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And who are the leading candidates? And if that changes, then the numbers will change. So really, the polls are really determining recognition. They're really determining name recognition, which is one of the things that Trump is benefiting right now, as well as Hillary Clinton. Just because 25% choose Trump, it isn't a plurality of anything. It's 25% of the people in that poll who pick Trump as the guy they might vote for in next year's primary in Iowa, which is a caucus. So you see what I'm saying? And what of that? Well, here are some rules that I've learned after polling thousands of people over the years on a variety of subjects for media, television, radio, some products, things like that. And, you know, some of this stuff is debatable. I'm sure the people out there who are market research people and so forth will say that's true, that isn't true, this is true, that's true. Political scientists may have different views. But I would say, on balance, most of these are fair caveats when it comes to polls. So here are some rules, as I said. First of all, people cannot respond to something that doesn't exist yet. So if a candidate gets in the race later who is amazing, let's suppose that Kanye West decides to run for president and everybody likes Kanye West, or who's the man that became a woman on the reality show. If she decides to run for president and people think this is a great guy, then that's going to change the nature of the race. And you can't ask people to respond to something that they don't know what is going to actually happen the day that they go into vote or caucus. You can't poll products people haven't tried. And they have been trying to do this for years. I hear these stories all the time in the packaged goods industries. I just heard one recently. A guy said that they had developed some, I forget what it was. It was some kind of food that wasn't supposed to be able to be frozen. And they figured out how to do it. And they were super excited about it. And the company said, well, it doesn't poll well. This has never polled well. And the guy that was talking to me said he told them, you know, that's because you've never actually put it out there to try it. So they can't possibly know. And yet all the people that have tasted it when we did taste tests say that it's great. So they kind of came to an impasse because the company was afraid to take a risk on something that had never existed before. Another example of this is, and it's a classic polling story, back in the 1950s, was probably in the late 40s, they conducted a poll, and it was probably done by Ogilvy or someone like that, and when they used to do polling in those days, they would go to the train station because everybody went to the train station because people didn't have phones in those days. So they went to the train station and they would pull people aside and give them a poll. And the car companies asked people what their ultimate car would be like. And the men said, I want headspace for my hat. I want to be able to wear my hat while I'm driving, so I need to have lots of headroom so it doesn't get stuck on the ceiling of the car. And so Chrysler took this information to mean that they needed to build these big boxy cars. And so in the early 50s, that was fine. But then as we moved forward to the mid-50s, cars started to get streamlined because cars are aspirational. Cars are architecture. And people were thinking about the jet age and the space age, and they weren't thinking about their hat anymore. And Chrysler came out with these big boxy cars, and Chevy and Ford came out with streamlined jet age type cars like, if you know cars, then you know what I'm talking about. And obviously, the end of the result was that the Dodges and the Plymouths really suffered because they listened to polling data that you couldn't ask people about that. And I've seen people in radio do this again and again and again. They ask them about format options for radio stations that don't exist, and they think it means people want that. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. What it takes is experience and knowledge and understanding, because it's an art. you know, and you have to understand what the polls mean. And I've seen many executives make really bad mistakes because they thought the poll said this when that's not what it meant, right? So people can't respond to something that doesn't exist yet. You can't poll products that people haven't tried. You can't ask them to evaluate something that simply doesn't exist. You can ask about attributes for particular things, like what does a president look like? But you can't say, would you vote for a guy who had red hair and said crazy stuff? Or would you vote for someone who had achieved notoriety as a wrestler? Or would you vote for an old guy who described himself as a socialist Democrat, right? So that's one of the big problems with polling, because we're so far out. So all this polling for presidential primaries essentially is meaningless. Even the polls for the presidents are meaningless until right up before the election. My favorite example of this, and before I get into it, you know, Donald Trump said this week, I think polls are great and I love them. Well, he's leading in the polls. He won't think that. He said he'll get out of the race if his poll numbers go down. And he says most of them are accurate, but some of them aren't, which is another meaningless statement from Donald Trump. But I remember in 2012, you know, the polls were very close. They were too close to call. And if you go to Real Clear Politics, they will average the polls. But you can't average apples and oranges. You can't average North Carolina with Iowa, because they're different elections. So primaries, you can't average the polls really, but they do it all the time. And they say, well, this means that this one's in the lead and that one's in the lead. And I remember right before the 2012 election, Republicans were absolutely convinced that Mitt Romney was going to win the election. And you could not disabuse them of this idea, and you couldn't explain to them that the polls were too close to call and that he could win or he could lose. And I will never forget election night. We did the election coverage live at a really nice comedy club in Minneapolis, Acme. And as soon as Hamilton County, Iowa, Ohio results came in and Romney lost Ohio, people were completely shocked, and they got up and they went home. These are Republicans, because they believed Fox News, which told them that it was going to be Romney's night. And nobody was more surprised than the people on Fox News. So nobody knew what the hell they were talking about, except I said consistently up until the election, this is too close to call. You can't know this because it's 50 states that are going to be electing the president. And it's an electoral college strategy, because they actually elect the president. And you can't say who's going to win, because there's no clear advantage. You know, Romney led by two, Obama led by one or two or three or four or five. And if you went through individual states, and here's what I did. The night before, I went through and I analyzed every state. And I came to the conclusion that Romney would probably not win. And I was right. So the primary races, by the way, I was also wrong about the 2014 election, which turned out to be a Republican wave election, and I didn't believe that it would be until right before. Those polls turned out to be correct. But see, the difference with that is those are polling individual congressional districts. They're tighter, they're smaller areas, and they're easier to poll to a certain degree. Now, some people might take umbrage with that statement, but I think off-year elections are probably a little easier because you're looking at individual races, and you're also looking at districts that have long results. You know, you can go back, you know, years and years and years for an individual district. So it's almost easier to predict congressional races in off-year elections. But the primary races for president are dependent on turnout and local issues in 50 states. Now, again, the primaries are selecting a political candidate. They're not actually voting for a president. Once people actually start voting in the primaries or going to caucus, there will be a lot of surprises. Remember that Michelle Bachmann won the Republican caucuses in Iowa in the 2012 cycle, and people don't know why. And I'll tell you why. Because Michelle Bachmann was able to mobilize Christian evangelists who showed up in buses, and she was able to flood the caucuses with her people. It's the same reason that Ron Paul did well in Minnesota, because the Ron Paul people were very well organized and they could flood the caucuses. Caucuses are notoriously dependent on organizing and mobilization, as really are the primaries in any election in which only 15 to 30% of the population actually votes. So if you've got a good ground game, if you've got a lot of money to spend, if you can do a lot of TV advertising in a primary election, or you can make sure that your people get out to be in a caucus, you can win New Hampshire, and you can win Iowa, and you can win Minnesota. And the political choices in this country are then affected by these votes, because as the media covers the primaries, the early primaries, which have nothing to do with the rest of the country, for example, Iowa, there's no reason for Iowa to be first in the nation, or New Hampshire. Neither one of these states is really representative of the United States as a whole at all. And yet, if you win the Iowa primary, you're suddenly a big star. I'll never forget Michelle Bachmann walking through Radio Row at the Republican National Convention in Tampa with, I mean, you should have seen, it was as though she was a queen wearing a white dress, walking through Radio Row, tailed by literally scores of television reporters and cameras from all over the world, because she won Iowa, you know, and she was not the candidate in the end. So, that's a really important point. The other thing is, political choices in this country are affected by what happens in the rest of the world. So if war breaks out in the Middle East because of the situation with Syria, Russia, the Gulf states, and Israel, then the entire picture that we're dealing with right now changes, and it throws all of these polls right in the trash so far. Or if we have a recession or an economic depression, which starts this summer or next summer or this winter, then you can throw all of the poll results out, because the electorate is going to start changing their mind. And again, you have no idea what those people are going to do when they actually go to the polls. And you can add to that list any number of potential problems in the news that can affect primaries and the outcome of a general election. So will Donald Trump fade, as Dana Milbank says he will? Maybe and maybe not. Could he win a general election? Yes, emphatically, Donald Trump could win a general election. Could Hillary Clinton be the nominee? Would she fade? Maybe, maybe not. It's hard to tell. Could she win a national election? Yes, she could. And so could Bernie Sanders. And so could, Marco Rubio. And so could any of these candidates. The thing that bothers me is it's not up to the networks and the pollsters and the national parties to decide which candidates we get to choose from. And yet, they are doing that. They're going ahead and they're deciding based on faulty polling information, which is dependent on whatever happens. What happens, for example, if we allowed the polls to choose Donald Trump right now, and something happens in the next 3 or 4 months that is out of his ability to deal? We've then chosen 3 or 4 candidates based on their poll, or Ben Carson, or Bernie Sanders, or Hillary Clinton, or whatever. We are putting our own lives at stake by electing somebody who may or may not be able to serve based on some polling data, which is faulty. And the reason I've done this is so people understand the limits of this stuff. And this is why I tell people, don't pay attention to any of this stuff right now, because none of this stuff has gelled. We have a long way to go before this race even begins to gel, and there are going to be a lot of surprises, or there are going to be no surprises. It'll be Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And we can't know what the future holds. And we spend a lot of time in this country trying to predict the future. And we think that we have all these tools that allow us to predict the future, and they're not any better than an astrologist or a tarot card reader or somebody like me who just says what they think, because I can be right 50% of the time or 30% of the time. And, you know, stock pickers, if they're right once, as I've said before, they'll make a career on this. And yet we buy into this idea that the polling data has some sort of value and importance. And the thing is, it can be right or it can be wrong. There's no rule that says that it's going to be right all the time. So I would throw all of that out. I would turn it off. I would go read a book like Scott Gordon's Controlling the State, or I'd read The History of Rome, or I would read your selection of novels, and wait until next summer before you start paying attention to this stupid election, because they're choosing for us who we are going to appoint to be the most powerful person in our government. And I think it's a travesty, and I think it's a huge failure of media coverage and journalism and everything else, because nobody's talking about the fallibility fallibility of these polls and the fallibility of a process that includes so much of the media and so little of the actual electorate. Let these guys go out and campaign. Let them go to the state fairs. Let them go to the meetings. Let them stand out in front of the plants on a cold winter day in New Hampshire. Let them go talk to people. But let them do what they do, and let's not grade them on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, because what you get out of that is somebody who figures out that they can goose the polls by saying something that people end up talking about on social media and online and in the media again and again and again, and they can use that to their advantage. So I'm not sure that we get the best candidate this way. I think we end up with the most common denominator, which is not necessarily the best thing for the country. So there you go. You now know as much as I know about polling, and hopefully you'll treat it with a jaundiced eye. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. And speaking of the political season, I just started getting ready to figure out the winter campaign season and the mobile podcast command unit. I'm going to do a grand trip, probably starting with the primary / caucus, whatever it is, in Iowa, and then heading south. Because many of those Mid-South states, Tennessee and places like that, forgive me if I didn't get Tennessee right, but a lot of those states are either early primary states or they're Super Tuesday states. And so I'm accepting donations for the Bob Davis Mobile Podcast Command Unit to be heading down into that region at the beginning of campaign season. Now at thebobdavispodcast.com, you just click on the donate button with a picture of the podcast ambulance. It'll take you to PayPal and you can donate safely and securely. And thank you for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and bdavis7843 on Instagram. I love Instagram. It's my favorite. And thanks for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 421. Pup.
Now listen, Julie, baby, it ain't natural for you to cry in the midnight. Crash.